for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Americans are saving. Major retailers this week reported disappointing sales. Many retailers are cutting inventory in anticipation of weak demand for back-to-school supplies and the holiday gifts. But many economists are predicting an improved outlook for the second half of this year. Joining me here in the studio to talk about how consumer spending affects the recovery of the U.S. economy, economist Douglas Holtz Aiken, Wall Street Journal economics reporter Sadeep Reddy, and economist Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute. We are going to welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Joining us by phone from California, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who is currently a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley. Good morning to you, sir. It's been a long time.
It has, Diane. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. Tell us how you interpret the weakness in consumer spending in the U.S.
Basically, Diane, consumers don't have any money left. In fact, they're deep in debt, a debt load of something in the order of $5 trillion, including a huge mortgage debt. About one in three people or families with mortgages are now owing more on their homes than their homes are worth, because houses have dropped on average across the country by about one-third in their value. So you don't get a very pretty picture. At the same time, you've got millions of baby boomers who have not saved for retirement because they assumed that they had more in their 401ks than they actually do. They assumed their houses were worth more than those houses actually are. People can no longer use their houses as piggy banks in terms of refinancing and also consumer loans, home equity loans. So if you look at all of the pieces, you see that there's really no way for consumers to spend nearly like they were spending before 2007. The median wage, by the way, adjusted for inflation, actually dropped between 2001 and 2007. So there's very little likelihood that even if jobs start coming back, wages are going to soar enough to provide people the kind of cushion they need to pay off their debts and also start spending again. Well, you can see where I'm heading. There's just consumers who are responsible for about 70% of the U.S. economy are just not going to be revved up. They're not going to be able to spend.
And what about the savings factor? Americans are clearly saving more. And my question to you is why a higher savings rate is not good for economic recovery?
Well, it's very good for individual families. They should save more. But this is the old paradox of thrift, because if everybody saves more, even though it's good for them and their families, that's rational for them, there's less demand in the economy for all the goods and services the economy can potentially produce at near full employment, which means that at a time like this, especially, companies just are not going to hire more people. They may continue to lay off people. It's going to be very hard to get a vigorous recovery. In fact, it's going to be very hard to get much of anything in terms of recovery.
So one last question, then we'll bring in our other guests. How do you think the stimulus packages affected both consumer spending and the pace of economic recovery?
Well, I think the stimulus package, remember, had three parts to it. One was a tax cut, and that has taken hold, and that's helped families. And although families have used much of it to pay off their debts, it's still a good thing for families. The second piece was to help state and local governments, state and local governments need the help. I mean, they are already way behind the eight ball because the revenues, tax revenues, are so far down because so many people are either unemployed or their wages are in the doldrums. So the states need that, and that's had an effect. The third piece of the stimulus, Diane, was the actual government spending on infrastructure and other projects. That's really just beginning, and that should provide a little bit of help next year in terms of keeping the economy going. But that stimulus is just a one-time thing. It's not going to, there's not going to be a, at least I don't read, as I read the political tea leaves, there's not going to be a second stimulus. Mm. And so the question is, what happens after the stimulus?
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, he's professor of public policy at UC Berkeley. He joins us from California. Turning to you now, Douglas Holtz Aiken, do you agree with Robert Reich's assessment of where we are?
Well, I think he's touched the key points, which is that it's unlikely that the U.S. consumer is going to lead us out of this recession for all the reasons he mentioned. They are deeply indebted. They've seen their houses and their retirement portfolios badly damaged. There are not ongoing creation of new jobs. On the contrary, we're still losing jobs in the United States. And for those who have jobs, we're not seeing strong wage growth enough to generate spendable income. So it's not a great picture for those consumers. I think there are two things that people should keep in mind when they think about that. The second thing is it's also unlikely they're going to drag us further down. I think that we're going to see the consumer sector stabilize and perhaps modestly contribute to growth at best. And we will have to see other parts of the U.S. economy, business spending, our exports, be the drivers of this recovery. And the last point is they shouldn't be the ones to lead us out of this recovery. For two decades, America has been the last retail market on the planet. It has led to an enormous imbalance in the way the world economy is configured. Everyone produces, the U.S. consumes. It was never sustainable, and there's no reason to try to go back to that.
Douglas Holtz Aiken, he's former chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. And turning to you now, Sudeep Reddy, a part of this whole effort to get consumers to spend again has been this cash for clunkers. Now they're talking about cash for clunker appliances. Is that going to help get things moving? Or do you agree with Doug, who says consumers are not going to be the key to getting us out of this?
Well, Dan, one of the reasons the Cash for Clunkers program is seen as so successful is because it came at just the right time. And it's possible that a lot of the auto dealers might have been seeing the beginning of a recovery anyway, just because things had been going down for so long. And so the fact that this came in provided that jolt right at the right time and is pushing auto sales up and is really giving that little boost that you need going into the fall, and that's important. It's not clear whether it would help in every other way. Obviously, if you hand out money to people who are going to buy big things anyway, it's going to lead them to go and make that purchase probably earlier than they might have otherwise. But some people had been delaying purchases, so that would give a little bit of a boost. So that there's probably going to be too much controversy about extending this even more for something like appliances, other durable goods. But the auto recovery is an important one because that will give a little bit of a boost to consumer spending, given that we're at this what is generally seen as a turning point right now for the economy. The only thing we don't know is how long that turning point will last, if it's going to be something that is just a few months. And even though the labor market is still in pretty bad shape, jobs are still declining, it could be a few months before we even get to the point where we're just flatlining with the labor market. And then what gets us out of this, and that's where the different calculations around the stimulus come into effect. Is it going to give us a temporary boost? Is it going to give us something that becomes more sustained to get us into a more meaningful recovery beyond the next 6 months or so? And that's just what we don't know because there's so many issues hanging over consumers.
Sudeep Reddy, he's economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute, are we at a turning point for the economy, and to what extent are consumers part of that mix?
I'm not so sure we're at a turning point. I hope we are, because we've been headed pretty firmly downward, and a turning point would only be a good thing at this point. I think it's a little premature to call it a turning point. I mean, we're going to see in the quarter we just had, the second quarter of 2009, the third quarter of 2009, which we're in right now, we're going to see the maximum impact, I think, of the stimulus package in that sort of six-month window. Hopefully, as this impact of the stimulus package starts ebbing as we move into 2010, you hope the rest of the economy is healthy enough by then that it has its own sort of self-generating recovery process that pulls us through, even as the stimulus package is lending less oomph to the economy. It's not clear to me that that's the case. The labor market is really nowhere near even flatlining. We lost about 250,000 jobs the last month in the latest jobs report, and that actually felt like relief given how bad this recession has been. You know, you compare that job loss as a share of the total labor force and compare it to the worst months of the recession in the early 2000s and the worst months in the recession of the early 90s. It was a terrible month. It only felt like relief because we're in just such a savage recession. And so I think given that labor market problem, given the rising savings rate, the consumer's dead on its back, and then big parts of investment are pretty dead as well. I mean, residential investment, which is a big part of total investment in the economy, I don't think that's going to be a driver of growth for a long time. We're coming out of a really unsustainable boom period. And then the other thing is commercial real estate investment. I think that's going to be a very sustained big drag on the economy over the next year.
Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute. As you can hear, a very mixed picture. When we come back, we'll talk further and then take your calls, 800-433-8850. In this hour, a look at consumer spending, how it may or may not affect the economic recovery of the country. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Robert Reich, I want to ask you about cash for clunkers. What's your view?
I think it worked pretty well, Diane, but it was expensive. And even though Congress has allocated more money for it, it's analogous to the stimulus program in the sense that it does do a job. It does keep people employed more than they would otherwise be, in this case, the auto industry. This one also has the additional benefit of sort of environmental improvement because you're cashing in clunkers for new cars that are have just better mileage. On the other hand, it can't go on indefinitely. And I think that what you're hearing, and I am hearing from other people on your program, and certainly I agree with the proposition, that the stimulus cannot go on, consumers cannot go on buying, that if we do get a recovery, it's going to have to be from some other source of demand. And the big question, of course, is where that other source of demand is going to come from.
And I know you, Doug, want to comment on cash for clunkers.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of cash for clunkers, cash for appliances, cash for radio hosts, wherever we go next.
Nobody's offered me a dime.
You remember, the cash for clunkers was originally an environmental policy. But at least to my eye, $3,500 to raise your mile per gallon by 4 miles per gallon is not a sensible environmental policy. It's way too much money for far too little. The whole program amounts to about 2 days of imported oil. So this is a very high price for not much environmental benefit. So now we're trying to put a little lipstick on this cash for clunkers and calling it a stimulus package. And in fact, it's most likely to have its impact in just moving some sales out of inventory, some sales that might happen in 2010, into this summer, not really changing overall production very much, not really changing overall employment very much. And so we're not getting any money for this.
Sadiq.
That's true that it's probably pulling some sales up from before, but it came at the right moment. The reason there are some sales from ahead, and the reason it is seen as successful is because it came at a time when things were still looking pretty bad in terms of consumer spending and gave a little bit of hope for what is a pretty deeply distressed sector right now. And so just in terms of raising consumer confidence a little bit, getting people out thinking about buying cars, people who might not have gone to lots anyway, it was useful in that sense. But obviously it's a handout to people who were thinking about buying cars and Doug is right that there isn't a great environmental effect off of it that was intended. But it's seen as a stimulus, and the reason it got additional money is because it was having some support in what is a pretty awful picture right now.
All right, Josh, I want to give you the last word on cash for clunkers.
I think mostly in agreement. I'm slightly in favor of it. It's no silver bullet for sure. I do think, you know, durable goods, especially autos, is a very cyclical industry. It's something that people have pulled back on in an enormous way over the past year. If this shakes a couple sales loose, that's probably good for the economy, but it's sure not the answer to the economy's problems.
All right. We've gotten a number of emails about a new policy that goes into effect today, Sadiq, on credit cards. Here is an email from Bud in Key West, Florida. He says, I'm lucky and able to pay off my credit cards each month, except one which I choose to keep a balance on. The minimum payment has always been $15. Out of the blue, Chase Bank raised the minimum payment to $287, which I can pay. But what if I could not? This kind of mooching by banks is just another reason why consumers are keeping their money in their pockets, the unknown tricks that banks might pull to get the rug out from under the average family. Sadiq.
I certainly haven't heard anything as high as $287, but people are really seeing their minimums go up.
Tell me what the new rules are.
This is the legislation that President Obama signed in May that really fundamentally overhauls the credit card industry. The Federal Reserve and other regulators had already implemented a set of rules that would have taken effect next year. Congress came in, added a little bit more to it, and pushed the implementation date a little higher. The first changes go into effect today, and that's to give consumers more time to pay their bills. So it should give them about a week more to pay their bills. So it forces credit card companies to send them out a little earlier. And so you're not getting a surprise when the dates change or.
But is it also to raise minimums?
It gives you more. The first changes that go into effect today are for more notice on your bill and on your rate increases. Starting in February, there are a lot. There's basically a fundamentally big change in the credit card industry in terms of how they're able to raise rates on consumers across the board. And what credit card companies are doing are changing their policies ahead of that February period to some extent by charging customers more because they know they're not going to be able to do it when February comes around. And so I've certainly been getting some of my notices already for higher interest rates going into effect. And what people are going to see in February is that it's going to be harder to get credit cards than it was before because companies are going to be limited in who they can offer it to and how they can offer those types of credit cards. But right now, it's really the kind of the first leg of the financial overhaul, and that's what people are getting kind of upset about because it's coming at a time when consumer spending is already under pressure.
Exactly.
And it's forcing them to pull back even more. This is part of the debate that took place in the spring is how tough are you going to make your rules when people need to be able to borrow. But a lot of Americans felt like they were being abused by their credit card companies, and Congress reacted to it.
And, Josh, how is this likely to affect consumer spending?
I think in the short run, Not a whole lot. I mean, I don't think the big constraint on consumer spending over the past year has been inability of otherwise creditworthy people to get more loans. People are not looking to take on a lot more debt over the past year. And all of us are a lot less creditworthy than we were, say, a year, year and a half ago. If you own a house, you've got a lot less equity. And so it's not really a case, I think, that the banks have just sort of shut down the lending spigot to people who look the same in terms of their financial situation as they did a year ago. I think a lot of this anger is sort of a fallout of the bursting of the housing bubble. You know, when you've got a lot of equity in your home, you've got some leverage with your credit card company. You can take a mortgage equity withdrawal loan out and pay off your credit card, or you can sort of shop around and you're very credit worthy and you can get a better deal. That's all come to an end. And we've actually seen credit card delinquencies peak at the highest level since the Fed started tracking the data in 1991 recently. And so I think that sort of pinch, that people just don't feel like they're in as good a situation as they were a year ago, and they're feeling the squeeze on many different many different dimensions, but I think the credit cards are a big one of them.
Here's an email, let's see, from Joyce in Arizona, who says, I think an economy that depends on people spending beyond their means is not a healthy economy. My answer would be to put more stringent regulations on U.S. businesses that search the world for cheap labor. Virtually every product I buy has a label made in China or anywhere but the USA. My question, she says, is what products do we manufacture in the U.S.? I don't want to get off on that tangent, but Robert Reich, the question about imports versus exports and how all that may be affecting consumer spending.
Well, undoubtedly, Diane, a lot of this goes back to the fact that certainly this decade, median wages did not keep up. In fact, adjusted for inflation, they have declined. And that was really during a recovery, or a so-called recovery, between 2001 and 2007. And if the middle class is discovering that their purchasing power is dropping, well, it's not too surprising that they're going to try to keep their standard of living up by borrowing more and more as long as they can use their homes as piggy banks. The problem comes in when the piggy banks explode. They can't use those homes as piggy banks anymore. The bubble has popped. And now we're seeing a lot of anger and resentment. Anger and resentment that could turn into kind of a backlash against international trade, a backlash against immigrants, all sorts of backlashes as people worry about their jobs and their incomes. I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, I think that a healthy economy is one in which people feel relatively secure. And the sooner we're back to that, the less we have to worry about those kinds of backlash.
Robert Reich, what do you see behind the kinds of positive predictions we've heard that the recession may have bottomed out? And do you believe that to be the case?
Well, all we can say, Diane, with some certainty right now, is that things are getting worse more slowly. Now, that may not be much consolation to people who are listening. I do think that we may be, as we say, bottoming out. That is, we may be reaching about as bad as we're going to get. But even that is not much consolation because unemployment is so high. We've got not only 9.4% of our labor force unemployed, but a lot more who are just underemployed. They've either given up looking for work or they're working part-time and they'd rather be working full-time. So I wish I could be more optimistic.
Getting worse more slowly, Douglas.
The fact of the matter is that I don't see a vigorous recovery anytime soon.
Doug?
Definitely. No jobs in sight yet. If you look backwards at what happened to the U.S. economy, the single biggest indicator of where we were was the labor market. After they did all the revisions to all the accounting, everything lined up with when employment started to fall off in December 2007, and things were much worse in 2008. Than we initially thought, and we should have known it because the jobs were disappearing in 2008. So until the job market turns around, there's no reason to declare victory. I do think there are two hidden secret linings to higher saving that ought to be mentioned out there. I mean, number one, there's this notion that somehow people save some of the stimulus. Well, good. Because when they did that, they paid off some of their credit cards, they paid off some of their debts, and that money went to the banks that were so fragile that had they not gotten a little more cash in on their balance sheets and less in the way of bad loans, they wouldn't have healed as quickly as they have. It's been remarkable how quickly the financial sector has sort of gotten into better shape. And I think part of that is because we didn't see a big, massive credit card default. We didn't see some other stresses that could have taken place. And we're not out of the woods there by any means, in my view. Second thing is, suppose we save more as a nation, and then we could lend some of that saving to people in Brazil, and we could lend it to people in Russia, we could lend it to people in Indonesia, and they'd have money from those loans to buy U.S. products. Well, that would be a remarkable reversal from a world in which the Chinese have lent us their money to buy their products. And so saving a little bit more as a nation is not a bad idea.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sadiq Reddy, how do you respond to that?
Well, of course, internal saving in the United States would be a better thing, and there's really no doubt about it. People should be saving more. We, as Americans collectively, we're spending too much and spending beyond our means. But the concern is, of course, how we're going to get out of this dive that we've been in. The economy is probably growing a little bit right now. The job market is still in pretty bad shape, but if we're going to see the saving rate stay high, then it's just going to prolong the pain for everybody who's on the bad side of the labor market right now. People who are unemployed will probably stay out longer because if people are saving more, they're spending less, and if they're spending less, then the overall economy isn't going to be driven by consumer spending, obviously, and it's going to keep us down a little bit longer.
Josh.
I think he just made a very important point. I mean, I definitely agree with Doug that we eventually want to be an economy that runs a much lower trade deficit, that does not rely totally on the consumer to drive the economy forward. It would be great to get some demand out of net exports. And that's clearly, I think, where we want to end up. The real question is the process by which we get there. And that's over the next couple of years. How do we sort of wean ourselves away from the consumer-led economy into this more healthy, long-run economy? And that's where I think the stimulus package comes in. I think the stimulus package was essentially meant to be a bridge to that economy where we don't rely so much on debt-driven consumer spending. Government was going to take up the slack for a couple years, where hopefully we get some boost from net exports and private investment in the longer run. The bridge might not be long enough. I mean that economy where we get to where we rely a lot on net exports and private investment to pull the economy forward, that still might be a couple years down the road, and the stimulus package does not last that long. And so I think we really need to be talking about, you know, did the stimulus package get us there, or do we need even more help to get to that healthier long-run economy that
but
we're talking about?
But how long is it going to take before the full effects of the stimulus are actually felt in this country?
Well, I actually think we're sort of feeling the maximum impact of the stimulus package probably in the quarter we're sitting in right now.
Do you agree with that, Doug?
I think it's as good as it's going to get. I'm not a big fan.
Do you agree with that?
I think there's still a large chunk of it that we're going to see coming through infrastructure projects, construction over the next 6 months or so, and that's an important step. And the tax cuts are actually spaced out. It's not an immediate check that people got. And so that's something that we don't actually recognize because you're not seeing the big boost of people going out and buying televisions with their tax cut, but it's something that stretches out over 2 years, really, and so that is providing a support that is invisible to a lot of people, but it's there.
Bob Reich, do you see the effects of the stimulus package being felt primarily in this quarter or farther out?
Diane, I think that we're going to see the effects primarily in the last quarter of this year, and probably the first half of 2010, and that's when we need it. That's good. It's kind of an insurance policy against the economy just not recovering at all. My worry is what happens after the stimulus is over.
You're feeling as though there's going to be a big drop?
Well, I worry about a kind of a double dip. That is, again, the theme of this this program so far has been the consumers really are not going to have the wherewithal to continue their spending, and we've got to get aggregate demand for goods and services from someplace else. But it's going to take a lot of adjustments to get to the point where that demand comes from exports. It just can't continue to come from government because we have to worry about inflation or higher interest rates as our government deficit gets larger. It's not going to come from business investment unless businesses are convinced that there are customers out there to buy their goods and services. So, again, that question mark is going to hang over the economy once the stimulus has been over.
Doug?
2 points on the stimulus. The first is it's about a two-year program. That means that about 12% goes out every quarter. That's about how fast it's gone out. So this is what it's going to be, which is not very good. And the whole notion doesn't work because you can't replace the lost wealth. We lost $14 trillion in wealth, and there's no amount of stimulus that replaces that.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, he's former chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. Robert Reich, he joined us from the University of California, Berkeley. Right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Aliens and extraterrestrials make for great summer blockbusters and sci-fi novels. Some believe aliens are out there, and NASA recently launched a telescope to search for planets that could support life. An update on the search for ET, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We'll go right to the phones as we talk about consumer spending, consumer savings, and what effects those are having on the U.S. economy. Let's go first to Farmington Hills, Michigan. Good morning, Keith. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
That's good. I was just listening to the comments being made about the Cash for Clunkers program, and I would just like to respectfully disagree about the success of the program, because I'm here in Michigan, and it's a major story here that a lot of the dealers aren't being reimbursed for their cars, and they have, you know, like all these cars out here that they haven't been reimbursed from the government for because of a lack of enough processes to process the applications, and a lot of the dealers here are pulling out of the program, and I just wanted to know what your panel had to say on that. Thank you.
Keith, I'm glad you called. There was a report on Morning Edition this morning that the government has had to hire more people to process those applications for Cash for Clunkers more rapidly.
I'm not surprised. The program runs through the Department of Transportation. It's not an agency that usually handles this kind of financial transaction.
Right.
And an agency that does all the time, the IRS, takes 6 months to get our rebate check. So the notion that somehow this money was going to flow right to the dealers was never, I thought, realistic.
And that makes it hard for the dealers, doesn't it?
It does, but the dealers are getting are ultimately going to get big checks that they might not have gotten at this moment otherwise. And so they're probably on balance pleased with this. They're just concerned of whether they should keep selling cars under this program because the money could be running out at some point in the near future and they don't want to get stuck in that period in between. But they've been praising a government program. You generally don't see car dealers praising the government as much as they have been over the last couple of months. And so on balance, they should be pretty happy.
Josh?
Yeah, I think definitely we should make sure that dealers aren't offering this program and not going to be reimbursed.
Right.
And surely we need to make sure that the promises are kept.
The question is, has the money run out? I mean, they offered a second cash for clunkers, $2 billion. And has that run out? Have they used it all?
Well, this was only intended to go into September, and right now we're looking at perhaps a Labor Day stop date for the program. And so the program has done what it was most recently marketed to do, which is to get people to go out and spend time on dealer lots and buy some cars, some people using cash for clunkers, some people not, and buying cars anyway, which is what the government wanted when it added the $2 billion.
All right, let's go to St. Augustine, Florida. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Hi, thank you for the show, and welcome to all your guests. I'm calling from a very old city, and we've been dependent upon travel and tourism for many, many years, and we have suffered down here, and I think your panel, or at least the associates in the economic department, have overlooked the 1-2 punch. In other words, number one was the complete chaos we had when the oil prices skyrocketed to $140 a barrel. We had the restaurants go out of business. We had a very nice airline, a moderate-sized airline, go out of business because of the price of oil. We had the travel drop 20%. People like the Blue Ridge Parkway and the other trails saw a 20% decline. Now, this to me is at our vitals. It struck at our vitals. People here remember back 70 years ago, and I come from that area, that the start of World War II started in about 2 weeks, the ceremony, the observation. The U-boat commanders used to pick out the tankers as they went by. They let the others go by, and they knew where our weak force was, and OPEC knows where our weak place was, and we don't have supply and demand when it comes to oil. We have OPEC and demand. So what we have is a need for our government to fix this in a way that they can do right now. They can put a hold on all trades on fuel oil, gasoline, and motor oil, and heating oil on the market by saying that you can go ahead and deal in these, but you have to take a delivery, or you have to make a supply within, say, a week in order to deal on this.
All right. Doug Aiken, do you want to comment?
Well, I think one thing to notice is that this recession is very severe, but it's not the same everywhere. And that's always true in recessions. One of the striking features of this one is that almost no area has escaped the downturn. It's often the case that we have states of that never fall during a recession. This one's bad everywhere. And those reliant on tourism certainly have been hit hard. Big increases in oil prices are never good news for the U.S. economy. To go to $140 a barrel was a very strong blow. It hits the mechanics of the economy, but it really hits consumer confidence. There's a strong correlation between high oil prices and people getting very nervous about the future. And when they're nervous, they don't travel.
Sadiq.
And when oil prices were at $147 a barrel, it was leading into last fall's financial crisis. So people were already pulling back, already fearful of the economy overall. And so that contributed to going into the deep dive that we went into. But it's a really important point that oil prices, when the economy recovers, oil prices are going to go back up again, because if the global economy is recovering, demand is going to go up. And there was always a very tight margin there. And OPEC obviously is a cartel, and the caller does make a correct point there. And OPEC will do what it generally does in cases like this. And so when oil prices are rising during what we hope will be a recovery, that's just going to dampen the recovery and raise more of the discussion about a double dip recession and put us back at risk again. And so we really haven't seen any meaningful effort to fix that problem for the long term.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Larry.
Yeah, good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
How are y'all doing? Well, I've got a kind of couple things on that cash for clunkers deal. You know, that money just don't go straight to the head man at the dealership. You know, that trickles down through the mechanics, through the body shop, through all the, you know, and then all the parts makers that make these replacement parts and stuff. It you know, you're making a misconception. But I want to know why they want to keep pounding this, giving small business tax breaks. Because if nobody can afford it, you know, buy their product, they ain't going to hire. So what are they going to do with that tax break? Come on, honey, let's go get a new Escalade. Is that what they're going to do? You know, I want to see people get more money in their pockets so they can save and spend, too. They can't do both when you're on $6, $7 an hour.
All right, Josh.
I think there's a good point there. I mean, if you look at what was in, say, the stimulus package that passed in February, there's lots of stuff in there that I think was good and is going to help the economy, the infrastructure spending, the sort of across-the-board tax cuts to everyone who works. There was also some, especially in the next 2 years, there's going to be a lot of money spent on business tax cuts that are going to do very, very little to stimulate the economy. I mean, there's even some the tax cuts that kind of are going to let people carry back losses from this year and apply them against previous year's tax bills. That's going to do nothing to stimulate the economy. I mean, there can be discussion about what works and what doesn't work in the stimulus package, but those business tax breaks strike me as kind of a pure bribe that was needed to be paid to get the larger stimulus package passed. And, you know, we probably won't get another stimulus package, at least by name, but if we do, we really should look closely at what works, what does not work, and those business tax breaks just really don't make the grade as effective stimulus.
It was not a good bill, and the list of flaws is very, very long. That's on the list. I think it's worth thinking about the basic strategy. American households are $14 trillion poorer. If they follow rules of thumb, they should spend about $600 billion less every year. The idea that somehow the government is going to borrow $600 billion, hand it to the households, and say, go spend it to somehow replace that lost wealth is completely misplaced. We are not going to replace that lost wealth. And so we are going to have to find new configurations for the economy that certainly don't involve the government somehow stepping in and trying to replicate a reality that's gone.
Well, but
and that's
like
what the stimulus bill tries to do.
Like what? What are you saying?
I think the fundamental goal should be to allow households to not further decline. And there's good evidence that they're starting to stabilize. The big fear I have there is ongoing foreclosures. Until we deal with that problem, I'm not convinced that we're going to see a genuine stabilization. On the other fronts, our efforts should be devoted to making sure that we are internationally competitive and selling abroad. Our efforts should be devoted to building business spending, building stronger research and development programs in the U.S., building stronger investment programs for manufacturing facilities in the United States. That's a place that would be a productive way to lead us out of the recovery and help in the long run.
All right. To Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, BB. Hi there. BB, are you there? I guess not. Let's go to Johnny in Pikesville, Maryland.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
I would like to make a comment on something that was said about 20 minutes ago as far as American people not having the money to spend on things. And somebody commented that every time they go to the store, it seems that, oh, well, the thing was made somewhere else. It's mainly China. And I'm not an economist, but I've been saying for years that the ultimate ridiculous situation would occur where all the U.S. manufacturers have shipped all their manufacturing over to other countries and have extremely cheap products to sell. Unfortunately, there's nobody working that's making any money that can buy them. And I think that however it's done, and I don't know, I'm not the economist, there must be a way to bring some of these jobs that used to be here back here.
So deep.
there probably isn't a way to bring the jobs back here.
Because
there, as long as we have a policy encouraging open trade with other countries, then the jobs are going to stay there, or they're going to move around among those countries where they're competing for lower cost labor. And the chances of getting jobs back from overseas are probably pretty low right now. There could be more of an effort to keep some jobs here if there are ways to do that. And I'm sure Josh has a number of ideas there, but getting jobs to come back is just it's really not in the cards right
Josh.
Now.
Well, I mean, specific jobs are not coming back, that's for sure. But, I mean, essentially, if you look at our trade flows, our imports and exports, I mean, you're mostly talking about manufacturing goods. That's the dominant thing we still trade in the world. And if you look at employment in manufacturing, it's below 12 million right now. That was the latest job report. We went for like 35 years between 1965 and 2000, never getting below 16.5 million. And so there's no reason to expect us to have such a low number of people in manufacturing. What has changed between that 35-year period and the last decade? Pretty much only one thing I see, and that is the huge ballooning of our trade deficit. And if we can reverse that, we can get a lot of those manufacturing jobs back. The way you reverse that is a more competitive value of the U.S. dollar. Predominantly.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So what you're saying is, as Sadiq said, none of those jobs are coming back, but you do need to somehow stabilize the working economy here in this country so that no more jobs are lost.
Now, I would go further. I mean, we can definitely get on net more manufacturing jobs than we have today if we start closing that trade gap. They won't be the same jobs as before. If we lost a t-shirt factory 5 years ago, we won't get that same t-shirt factory to come back to the same place, obviously. But, you know, it's a changing economy, but we can have many more manufacturing jobs 5 years from now than we have today if we keep that trade deficit decline or at a stable, low level, even as we enter recovery.
But just to get back to our point about consumer spending, whether it's made abroad or whether it's made here in this country, if consumers don't have dollars to spend, they're not going to spend it.
Yeah, I think on the jobs, there's this romantic notion that somehow the jobs should be here. And what happened was they closed the factory, they built it somewhere else, and then
right.
They sent the same product back. That doesn't happen. You can go look at the data. We don't see manufacturers closing a facility here, building it abroad, and sending the same product back. What we see is, number one, a lot of productivity growth in manufacturing. That's a good thing in the big picture, but it means that they don't need the same number of employees to produce the same amount of stuff. That's been a very striking feature in manufacturing. Number two, the rest of the world is the growth market of the future. We're a very developed country, and so manufacturers want to get into that growth market, and it's often cheaper to build the manufacturing close to the market as opposed to make it here and sell it abroad.
All right.
Don't want to cut that off. That's a good thing in the big picture.
Let's see if we can now get BB in Durham, North Carolina on. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi there.
My concern has been for years, before any of this happened, that there's too much emphasis in our nation on consuming and consuming and consuming, and that's the result of greed with a capital G. My hope has been that this drop in our economy would wake people up to that fact, and it bothers me that we're still talking about consuming and spending and goods. There are so many things we need to do for one another in this country. We need health care, and thank goodness at least we value our nurses and pay them decent salaries.
All right, Sadiq.
There may be a fundamental change in how people think about spending now. We just don't know that yet. They're saving more. That may be temporary. It may be longer term. It's certainly trending higher. The saving rate was at zero at one point this decade. So they're saving more. What the caller is really getting to is, are our values changing as a result of this crisis?
Can the U.S. economy get out of its recession, considering that 70% is dependent on consumer spending? Can it get out of the recession without that kind of spending?
there are ways to get out of the recession. The question is whether it will be a strong enough recovery without a lot of consumer spending. So just the business investment and the bounce back that we've had from a deep recession is enough to get us out of the recession. But this is really more of a question for if consumers aren't spending like they did before, what happens in the second half of 2010, 2011, 2012?
Josh.
Yeah, I've got a lot of sympathy with sort of the emotional point of view that the caller is expressing. But, you know, there's no morality tale in sort of macroeconomic aggregate numbers. And if you're looking for one, it's really tough. I mean, just to take one thing, she mentioned healthcare. Healthcare spending is actually part of consumer spending in the national health accounts. And it's actually been a big and growing part of consumer spending. And obviously not many people think that's greed or anything like that. So, you know, you do have to separate the morality from the macroeconomic, I'm afraid.
And we'll have to leave it there. Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute, Sadeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal, Douglas Holtzaken, former economist for the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.